again.
On the web at WSLR.org. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Walker. Bob Connors is here. He's just looking at another document at the moment. And John Dickman is in the studio helping us out. And please excuse my voice. I have a little bit of a cold, but everywhere we're here, we're good, and we're live.
Well, can you hear me, Tom?
Yeah.
Can you hear me? Oh, you're okay, back. Okay. I wanted to save your voice, you know, and I.
Oh no, but. He gave us a thumbs up, and you didn't start, so I went ahead.
I didn't see his thumb. I want to let the listeners know that the opinions you hear today are strictly those of the host and the guests and do not necessarily reflect those of the management team, the board of directors, or any of the volunteers affiliated with the station. And Tom, we're happy to have John Dickman on the control board. And I want you to save your voice today, so you have some important questions, so hold the voice for that. And this is the Peace and Justice Report. And the guest we have during our segment of the show, the second half of the show, will be Justice Matters by the Sarasota Legal Aid. But the first half of the show, our guest is E. Scott Osborne. She's been on several times in the past. She has lived and worked in 7 countries on 4 continents, working in international development, law, and education.
It is.
She speaks regularly on activism and the global gender gap. Right now, she is working on a book about the lives of women and girls in India. She holds a BA from the University of Pennsylvania and an MPA from Princeton University and a JD from New York University School of Law. Scott was a Peace Corps volunteer in West Africa and is an avid amateur athlete. She's the president of Through Women's Eyes, which each year presents films by and about women's issues. That festival this year will be from March 7th to the 12th, March 7th through the 12th. So go ahead, Tom, and go ahead, Scott. Go ahead, Tom.
Well, yeah, Scott. Thanks for coming on the show again. You do so many things. We can talk about whatever's on your mind, you know, but gender violence, gender equity, abortion rights, political corruption. So many things.
Thank you. And thank you,
ahead.
Bob. And thank you for putting in the amateur athlete. You know, that's a personal thing of mine. But, you know, let me just start with one thing. I spoke at a conference earlier, actually it was last year, November, to educators about gender and about where gender comes from and how it shapes us. And I think that's super important to think about as we look at what's going on in our country today. We're sort of having a moment where, you know, gender keeps popping up in our politics. And, you know, there's so much concern about transgender rights. And we have candidates that are not just implicitly, but explicitly, you know, playing gender cards, either trying to be hyper-masculine or, you know, something like that. We have abortion on the ballot all over. So it's like gender is percolating all over. And back to the conference, you know, I really said to teachers, you are all, we are all, but they are all very important in shaping the next generation. And gender is something which is shaped. It's a social construct. I'm not talking about our sex we're born with, but how we behave and think and dress and talk as men or women or gender non-binary is a construct of our society. We all absorb that. It's not something we're born with. We know this because societies are different. Men and women do different things in different societies. They act differently. They dress differently. So we've created it. And I think that's good to remember because it also says we can change it if it's not working for us. So, and one of my things I talked to teachers about, I said, you know, it's really not working super well for men and women in our country in the 21st century. Women are disenfranchised by all kinds of measures in terms of economics, in terms of unpaid labor, in terms of representation in government and corporations. But it's also not working super well for many men. There's double the suicide rates for men than women. Men commit virtually all the violent crime, and that's not to blame them. It's to say, whoa, what are we doing to our men and boys? You know, that's unnecessary. Things like illnesses related to alcohol and drugs, much more heavily male. So we're also not helping our men. So just to kind of pull that together for a second, that means I think we should really take a fresh look at how we're socializing people, you know, not to be afraid of this, but really think about maybe some of these things can change for the better so that men and women in the 21st century, which is different, can think differently about some of these gender norms, because we are definitely in a moment of backlash, you might say, in the U.S. and in some other countries as well. So those are some thoughts. We could take that in all kinds of directions. I'm happy to.
Oddly enough, I was thinking about that same thing. You said it's all in the how the children are brought up. 100 years ago or 150 years ago, nobody on earth was alive, right? But we had similar attitudes, violence, attitudes toward women, spousal abuse. We had it was all there. So where did this next generation, where do they learn this? From their parents? From the social media, it's taught. And I was doing some research for today, and you're right. In the schools, it's taught when the boys line up over here, girls line up over there, or boys and girls, let's get going. I mean, there are a lot of unconscious things we do also, and we tolerate more raucous behavior from boys. So it's enforced and taught. So I'm glad you're dealing with the schools, you know, and what they can maybe do about it.
There's a lot of implicit bias. I say to most of the teachers, look, I don't think you're actively trying to say, you know, girls become nurses and boys become doctors. I think we're past that. But there's a huge amount of implicit bias. And the things you're talking about, we genderize a lot unnecessarily. And so because of that, and again, it's not just from schools. It comes from home. It comes from media. It comes from the toy stores, which are still pink and blue. You know, it comes from many sources. But by very early ages, just a couple of examples, boys learn to, quote unquote, dominate a group conversation. We see this by second and third grade. Yes. Girls learn that their place is to sort of shrink back. Again, these are generalizations. Of course, it's not everyone, but you do see that in classrooms. Boys are tolerated for interrupting. They learn to, quote unquote, own the stage. You know, they're born that way, but that's a learned behavior to, in a sense, dominate. You know, these are young boys we all know and love, but they're building up these accumulated senses of who they are and how they should become. So it doesn't just happen.
Entitlement. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. There's a sense of entitlement that is just implicit. And that builds up and that becomes an issue that we see ramifications. Boys are taught very, very early. When I say taught, I don't mean actively, but implicitly, to avoid things that are seen as feminine. You know, that's still a huge thing. If something is seen as a feminine, whether it's ballet or doing the dishes or whatever it is, boys, you really eschew that. And, you know, we have issues at homes today. Women are working like never before, and men are not picking up the slack on housework. Yeah. And the reason is, even though we think, you know, there's the younger men are much more attuned to this, we're not seeing it in terms of behavior. Younger men in their 20s and 30s, they'll often say they are for gender equality in the home and their wives or female partners work, and that's all fine. But in terms of things like housework and childcare, we're not seeing the change yet because it's seen as feminine, and boys are trained that you really can't take on things that are seen as feminine. We saw this in COVID. Women bore a huge burden. You know, it has many, 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 many effects. It affects violence in the home. So that kind of socialization, again, I think many men, when they're older, they realize they are bereft of close friends, especially male friends. They realize they may have missed out on a lot of emotional connections with their children, but not in their earlier in their work lives. Often older men will realize this. And so, you know, they could be socialized differently to be better off too.
Yeah. And, you know, speaking of social, we can't solve this one immediately, but social media evidently is making things as bad or worse. And the self-images of the teenage girls or women is being harmed in some way. The message is getting through there. You can't tell them not to take their cell phones. into the school, but you can maybe, I don't know.
Well, I'll tell you, I have mixed feelings on this. As a former educator, among other things, I think you can tell kids to stop bringing their cell phones to school. Schools won't do it, and teachers won't do it for other political reasons, and there's this overwhelming sense of safety and security. I mean, if you ask parents why, it's like, oh, what if something happens? So because we've got unsafe schools, whole other topic, there's this perception. We all know we did not grow up with cell phones in our schools. My children even were at the point where they did not. I am firmly for saying, not. Or at the very least, you know, it's somewhere in the backpack. This notion that schools have to have it. On the other hand, schools have not been helpful. Schools have shoved screens at kids constantly, you know, even before COVID. And I think that's a huge issue. Education is much better with human engagement. A screen is not a substitute, especially in the early grades. I'm not saying any of us couldn't take an online course and do fine. But in early years, personal engagement is critical for learning, and you don't get that from a screen. So schools have played a part in it. I think social media, there's a lot of talk about it being especially harmful for girls. I think one of the reasons is because by teen years, girls are much more attuned to social nuance. It's not a joke, you know? Your classic, quote-unquote, middle school girl will be hyper-focused on the emotional nuances of her friend and peer group, and boys tend not to be, because girls have already by that age been socialized that what's really important are the social dynamics, and not for boys. Boys tend to be more likely to be on other video games and gaming platforms by that age. So they're on screens, they're just not on so much social media. On the other hand, you know, social media can also connect people. I'm not an out and out opposed to it. You know, we would not have the whole Me Too movement, you know, without people being able to find one another and literally say, wait a minute, you too? I mean, that was huge. Many other things, you know, certainly globally, we've had political movements that really were positive because people could find one another. So I think, you know, being able to connect sort of democratically, you know, it's got some real ills, and it's got some real strengths. But I think people have abdicated a lot of child raising to, you know, the public in a way that they shouldn't. So that becomes a parenting issue, and not to blame parents. But, you know, we don't do a great job of that in our culture. We're really kind of in a gray area in terms of what we should tell or not tell children to do. So.
Two of the things you do that I admire is you have a film festival, which we're going to talk about, and you also have some museums, online museums of things like political corruption and cartooning and so forth. Let's talk about the film festival first, because that's important. It's coming up. Tell us all about it. Why these films were picked, and two or three of the most important ones, and get the dates that I'm on, and that website also.
Absolutely. And let me tell you also first why we do this. You know, as you and I know, you can stream anything you want these days sitting from the comfort of your home. Why do we still need a film festival that really targets particular types of films? And this goes back to our talk about media and gender. Women are still portrayed on screen in a very biased fashion. They're far more likely to be nude on screen than men. So again, think about a lifetime of accumulation of these sorts of images and what that says to all of us about women and what it says about men. That's one example.
Yeah.
And another example, even in advertisements, not just the advertisements on television, but like on Facebook and every place else, men speak 7 times more. Now, so think about that. Stop to count this up when we're being exposed to ads. But if you accumulate that over a lifetime, what does it say about, you know, who's the authority figure? Who's got the stage, if you will? So we know, and this, even though we have blockbusters like Barbie and, you know, and obviously some female movie stars who are phenomenally popular, it still, over 20 years, has barely moved the needle in terms of these media things that people track. So because of that, we feel it's still super important to elevate women's media. And that means through the eyes of women, literally. The topics are on everything. Our topics are not just on stereotypical female topics.
Right.
The topics are on everything, and I'll give you some examples. But what we want to make sure is that, one, women coming up in the film industry get a chance, get a leg up. We try to give them some of the credentials they need to keep going. And we want audiences to see their work. You can take any topic, and if people have had different lived experiences, whether it's gender or race or the country they were raised in, they're going to see things differently. You know, women are hardly any camera people and photojournalists. The images that we get from around the world are literally through men's eyes. There's nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with that at all. It's just a different life experience than other people might have. So we do this film festival. This year, it's the 7th through the 12th. We're delighted. It's based in Sarasota, and we're delighted that we are both on the online platform, so people can stream from wherever. And we are also in person in Sarasota, back in theaters this year. For those people who might be listening who remember our film festival before COVID, we were always in theaters for an entire weekend, and we're back with that again.
Yeah.
So we're delighted about that. We have 32 films from 17 countries. We're very international. It's one of the things we pride ourselves on. And it's a really carefully curated mix of both shorts and features that you don't see elsewhere. It's quirky. It's emotionally moving. Anybody who sees a film block, well, something is going to stick in your head in the future. So we open at Ringling College. Ringling College has been a wonderful partner with us this year and last year. We open at the college on Friday night, March 8th. We're going to have a celebration of our past 24 years. This is our 25th anniversary. And we're actually going to have our awards ceremony that night, as well as great lineup of films. And then we go all day Saturday and Sunday, the 9th and 10th of March. And that will be this year at the Sarasota Art Museum in the auditorium at the Art Museum, which, again, we're thrilled to have that venue. So that's super cool.
The website is throughwomenseyes.org.
It's throughwomenseyes.org. Yep. And that will take you to a link to the actual platform where you can buy tickets. Tickets are available now. You can buy single tickets for just film block. Or you can buy the entire pass online or in person. We actually reduced a lot of our prices because we want to make these films accessible to people. We are a 501c3, I should say. We are a not-for-profit. We reduced our prices this year. Single film blocks are $12. You can buy an all-festival pass for as low as $125 and see everything. So that's important because we want these films to be in front of people. We have one super interesting film, which is called Undivide Us, to go back to sort of political themes, which is about, it looks at the question of whether we as Americans are as divided as the media really makes us out. You know, is that accurate? Our media has an interest in creating divisions. We have a corporate for-profit media, with the exception of folks like you. And they have a vested financial interest in drama, in entertainment, in battles, in the horse race. So there's a question as whether we're really as divided as we think or as we're led to believe. And so this film shows focus groups of people from all over America who come together to talk about things like guns and abortion. And it really says, can, you know, the man with seven guns in his house speak and communicate and make friends with the woman who lives in a city and lost her brother to gun violence? You know, how do they talk? And so it's fascinating. It's called Undivide Us. That's on Sunday. We also have films. We have a fascinating film Saturday night called The Goat. That's from the Middle East. And that one actually is about a range of topics. Amira Sorvino is in it. Some of you may know or have heard of her if you're movie buffs. It's about implicitly about child marriage and norms around girls, but it's also about water rights and the rights of local people versus corporations. But it's in a narrative. It's really gripping. It's amazing scenery out in the desert. So you want to see that on a big screen Saturday night. We have a film, a short about a woman in Germany, a grandmother in Germany, who was an athlete and did all kinds of interesting things and then was paralyzed in an auto accident, wheelchair bound now, and how she remade her life. And this, I won't tell you everything, but it involves Lego bricks. And it's funny. She is just so upbeat. It's inspirational in the best sense of the word. We have, let's see. I should say we have 10 of our greatest hits this year because this is our 25th anniversary. We brought back 10 of our most popular films from past years. One of them is a film about a book club that went for 60 some years. It started in the 40s with a group of women in wartime Washington, D.C., and how they stayed together. If you're in a book club, even if you just like to read, you will think differently about talking with people about books and the ties that bind. That one is super interesting. We have two films about Afghanistan this year and refugees. If there are any veterans listening, we have a film about PTSD and a soldier who returns from Afghanistan and then is met by a refugee from Afghanistan. Super interesting, really explores that topic. I could go on. What am I missing, Tom? You usually tell me the things that I haven't mentioned about the film festival.
that's perfect. Yeah, I'm glad you're bringing back some of your greatest hits from the last 10 or 20 years that you guys have done such a great job. I'll be there on the live event. I prefer the live events, even though I
know a lot of people do. Yeah.
Even though I need captions. I can't hear that good, but I prefer experiencing it with people and then talking about it later and meeting everybody. So I'll be at those live events with you.
Let me just add one thing, if I could, about the live event. This year we have a panel. A lot of our filmmakers come back, but come to join us. Yeah. This year we will also be having a panel, and that's something we can do in the live that feels different and a conversation with the audience on one film. Yeah. And I think when people are there, there is a sense of shared experience, and you turn to the person next to you and it's like, did you know that? It's just, you know, it's a very shared experience. But we have one film called The Fight for Black Lives, and it's about how different people experience the healthcare system and how black and white people and brown people experience the healthcare system differently. It is fascinating and has some phenomenally well-grounded statistics that if you haven't researched this area will blow you away. We are going to have a conversation after that. The filmmakers are coming. We're going to have some local medical professionals come and talk to us as well. So healthcare affects us all, and it looks at some issues around how we view race and, again, implicit racism. And it's a fascinating film about a very important topic. And we have a conversation in place. Conversation's free. Come to the panel. And so that's a great one. And that's on Saturday afternoon. The film starts at 11:30. Our panel will start about 12:30, 1 o'clock.
So we've got a couple minutes left. I've always introduced you mentioning your book about women and girls in India. And you've never told us when it's going to be finished. And I'd like to inquire how that's going. Is it still in the works?
Thank you. It is still in the works. I wish I knew. I have a friend who is a much more accomplished writer than I am. And she says to me, you know, it takes as long as it takes. And I think, okay, it takes as long as it takes. And I confess, sometimes it gets put aside when it's film festival season. So this is my side topic. And yet this dates from when I lived in India for 3 years and then went back for many years. And as I may have mentioned, one of the things I did was I worked with teenage girls in an orphanage, and they were working on learning English. And this book is a little bit about that, but it's really about girls in India and some of the implicit gender issues that they encountered. It's also about, this was a Catholic orphanage, and if anyone knows anything about India, they know there are very few Catholics, but this is an indigenous Indian order of Catholic nuns, and they were responsible for these girls. And it also looks at their lives and how their lives sort of stepping outside both the dominant religion, which of course is Hindi, and the dominant roles where marriage and family is critical for women in India. And of course, they are removed from all of that. So it's a little bit also, not to tie everything into a neat ball, but it's also a little bit of a look at how all those norms affect us. So these nuns, whom I became quite close with, were able to have lives that in some ways were more free than many of the women and more open in a way, which confounds our stereotype of nuns. You know, many of us have these images of, you know, sort of cloistered women, and I watched them with great degree of independence, and it I had to stop and think about it as well. So it's part of that. But I really want to do justice to the young women now. I've stayed in touch with these young women. Many of them have gotten married and really how their lives are changing and what that says. India is a very gender segregated society, meaning roles for men and women are very tightly defined. So it's exploring that. And Tom, you will be the first one when I finish it and put the stamp on it. I'm going to email you and let you know.
Excuse me.
And while you cough, I'm going to mention one other film since I just we also have a fascinating film, which is good in the big screen, but good anywhere, about a group of 14 people who traveled to the North Pacific Ocean in search of the great plastic barge. They're researching, and they're all scientists, they're researching what's in the oceans, and it really deals with plastics in the oceans. It's a beautiful film because of some of the scenery, and you know, and it stays in weeks on this sailboat. And it also looks at some of the science that I'd never thought about. They're really doing kind of micro-level research about microplastics. And we sit here on the Gulf Coast right on the water. That's something we should all focus on.
So, okay, thank you, Scott. We've been listening and talking to E. Scott Osborne, athlete and activist at the film festival Through Women's Eyes, runs from March 7th through March 12th. Their new website is throughwomenseyes.org, and everything is there. Thank you, Scott, for being our guest.
Thank you always. Thank you, Tom and Bob. It's really been great.
Thank you, Scott.
I'll see you at the festival.
Okay, and great.
Bob, you were going to read my introduction for me since my voice is gone.
Yes, definitely, definitely. You're listening to Peace and Justice Report right here on your own community radio station, WSLR. And on the second half of the third Wednesday, we have Justice Matters, brought to you by Legal Aid of Minnesota. More than 90,000 residents of Sarasota, Manatee live in poverty, and Legal Aid of Minnesota provides free civil legal services to these residents by partnering with local lawyers. This week, we'll hear from Sarasota attorney Neil Lyons about his passion for pro bono work. Our co-host, as usual, are Linda Harradine and Larry Eager. Linda is the Executive Director of Legal Aid of Minnesota. Her staff of 10 and 200 volunteer attorneys provide the legal expertise necessary in court. And Larry Eager is currently serving his fourth term as the elected public defender of the 12th Judicial Circuit. So welcome, Linda and Larry.
And guests. Hey.
Yes, and thank you.
Go ahead, Tom. Yes.
Go ahead, Linda. Thank you, Linda. Go ahead.
Yeah, sure. I'm sorry that you're losing your voice, it sounds like.
All right. It's no big deal.
Anyways, it's wonderful, as always, to partner with the Peace and Justice Report every third Wednesday of the month. And we are here to provide insights into different legal issues and help people understand their legal rights and responsibilities. Sometimes it's difficult for people to know that they have a legal problem. For example, there's legal resolutions for evictions, domestic violence, discrimination, debt collection, guardianships, et cetera. And these can be life-changing problems for people. So it's really important to know your rights and seek help before a small problem becomes a bigger one. And we always like to remind people that the legal system touches every aspect of our lives. And so the inability to hire a lawyer can make a life-changing difference for somebody. So we hope that our segment today will provide some useful information and resources for our community. And as Bob said, today we're going to be speaking with Neil Lyons. He's an attorney at Larson Goldberg, and he is going to be recognized at the Florida Bar Pro Bono Service Awards ceremony in Tallahassee tomorrow at the Florida Supreme Court. And this award is very well deserved. Anyone that knows Neil associates him with pro bono. And we're beyond excited. I will be up there myself to see him accept his award. So today we're going to talk about his passion for pro bono and how he encourages other pro bono attorneys to take cases. And I just want to give a little background so people understand just the extent of work Neil has done. Since 2015, he's donated over 1,000 hours of pro bono services to Legal Aid of Minnesota. He also helped found the Sarasota County Bar Association's Access to Justice Committee, which helps coordinate pro bono service efforts between the local voluntary bar association, the 12th Judicial Circuit Pro Bono Committee, and Legal Aid. He gave the committee a running start, personally reaching out to over 30 attorneys to secure commitments for them to take pro bono cases through Legal Aid. That through this committee, he also, and I'm sure I'll talk about this later, they helped produce some instructional videos for clients who may need assistance in filing an injunction for protection against domestic violence. And the list is endless. So we're going to talk to him today about all of his good work. And so thank you, Neil, for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Linda.
Yes. Yes. So why don't we start with just some general information? Tell people who you are, what kind of law you practice, and just why you decided to become a lawyer.
Sure. I actually moved here, Sarasota, in 1995 when I was 14. And this is basically, you know, my home. My dad was in the Navy. So, you know, I went to the, you know, four different elementary schools. So I finally found this place to call home after such a long time. And it's kind of a bizarre situation that how I became a lawyer. It was one day my father-in-law said, you know, I think being a lawyer, that might be something for you, you know? And I was always a fan of watching those old John Grisham movies like The Client and movies like that, or The Rainmaker. And I never really knew at that time what kind of lawyer I wanted to be, but my father-in-law gave the seal of approval on it. So I thought it was a good idea. And then, of course, I was at that time a slave to the material. So, you know, I always dreamed of driving a Bentley around, and I figured the only way I'd be able to do that was to be a lawyer, because there was no way I'd be smart enough to be a doctor. So part of it was motivation on the part of my father-in-law, my father too. He thought it would be a good idea, and also a little bit of materialism. Which led me over to an interesting area of law called elder law, which is where I practice, which is what my main area of practice is now, which is, you know, estate planning, probate administration, trust administration, guardianship, which, you know, the individuals in this community are very, very fond of that particular area. But oddly enough, it's where I do the most pro bono, is in the guardianship area. So that's a little bit of my background and what I do.
And I think that's really important that people know that. I know there's a lot of news information and articles about guardianship for a variety of reasons, but that is a really big area for pro bono service and for legal aid clients. We have a lot of lower income clients that live in our area who don't necessarily have family in the area, and they need a guardianship. And so we need not just guardians to take those cases, but equally as important, the attorneys that will help represent them so that they can have proper care. And as Neil said, that is an area that he's done a lot of work with us for. So for those of you who don't know what pro bono is, it really translates to for the public good. And as we said, Neil's going to be getting one of the highest honors and awards from the state tomorrow on behalf of the 12th Judicial Circuit for our area. So why don't you just tell us how you got involved in pro bono and why you keep doing it?
So the interesting part about getting involved in it was when I started law school in 2008. And if anybody understands the significance of that date, that was a large economic crash, the start of what I guess is now known as the Great Recession. So as we're all myself and my classmates are sitting there, we're thinking to ourselves, now what are we going to do? Come the summer between our second and third year, there wasn't as many paid internships out there. So what I did was I got involved in a local legal aid organization here in Sarasota, Gulf Coast Legal, and they offered to give me a summer internship, you know, non-paid, to basically get a lot of experience in pro bono. So I grew to like it quite a bit and enjoyed it. So that's basically how I started it. And then by about 2014, I was offered a job over at Boyer & Boyer. And Andy and Ed over there are big supporters of Legal Aid of Minnesota, and they were very encouraging and allowed me to do it. And which that's another big part of this, too, is the way you're able to do this is you have a firm with managing partners who are supportive, like I have now with Julie Larson and Christina Goldberg here at Larson Goldberg. They're encouraging and supportive of it. So Andy and Ed were, and I just grew a liking to it. And you know, when you see parents of a developmentally disabled kid who can't afford an attorney, but they just need to keep doing what they've already been doing for their 18-year-old disabled child, and you see how thankful they are, and it's a rewarding experience. You know, it becomes a very rewarding thing, and it becomes oddly enough addicting. So that's kind of how I started in that guardian advocacy realm.
Neil, I'll jump in there. I apologize, but my link seems to be breaking up. So if I break up, please indicate. So first, I'm amused when you talk about the John Grisham movies as being old. I guess I'm old enough where I think of Perry Mason as old. So it does show the generational difference that we have. Tell me your commitment to pro bono work. I head up the public defender's office, and so I'd like to think that many of the attorneys who work in this office, it's a calling, and you have sort of approached it from the same perspective. And I think of the legal profession as being both the noblest of all professions, but as a result, it also can be the most ignoble of professions. I don't want to, you know, overly applaud your work, but how is it that we can how would you suggest that we reach the rest of the bar when we look at the small percentage of participants in the Florida bar, especially the Sarasota and Manatee County bars, in engaging in this sort of pro bono work? Why? What makes you so different from your brethren at the bar?
Well, what I'm about to say is going to sound a pinch esoteric, so you're going to have to excuse that for a second. But I sort of have a debt that I can never really repay. So when I mentioned that, I don't know if you were here for it, Larry, but when I mentioned that my father-in-law, John Socia, Dr. John Socia, my dad, Mel Lyons, they were instrumental in me becoming an attorney. My dad served in the military for 25 years. My father-in-law, as a physician, used to go into Harlem back in the 60s and provide medical care to individuals that couldn't afford it. So based on those two individuals' service, there, I would be, as I say, dishonoring their memory if I didn't do the type of service in my profession that those two gentlemen did. And I give them a lot of respect. And again, that's a debt that can't be repaid, but with more and more and more work. So that's the esoteric side of it for me. But also, it's the other thing is I see myself as part of this community that is Sarasota. So, and individuals that need legal representation, though they may be indigent, they're a part of this community as well. And I couldn't necessarily call myself a full functioning member of this community if I didn't also reach out and help them as well, because they are members of our community. And so that's a lot of what motivates me. Again, this bizarre esoteric debt that I have to pay back to my both individuals who are no longer with us. But also too, as being a member of this community and the importance of ensuring that other members of this community can get the help that they need if they want it. And I have a skill that allows me to do that. So, that's where it comes from me. But as far as getting others involved, you know, it's tricky. It's tricky because there are some firms where they encourage it. You know, there are large firms like, for example, Holland and Knight, Carlton Fields, where they dedicate 3-5% of their annual revenue to pro bono service. I mean, they make that a part of their culture. Locally, iCard Merrill does that. I don't know about the percentage, but they do that here. They have a big culture of doing that over there. And then, of course, you have other attorneys, you know, people like Chris Nigro over at Dickinson Gibbons who volunteers. You have Michelle Stefan, who ran Access to Justice. And a lot of them, they just have a passion like I do. But really, I think the way to do it is to start small, right? You start small, you do events like the Newtown Wills Project or the Law Days at the Library, and you get attorneys to volunteer and you sort of get them hooked on doing it. So you got to kind of start small in that way. Michelle Stefan, who, like I said, used to run Access to Justice. She's over at Malio Christopher and Toll. She had the idea of doing a 12-person challenge to get 12 attorneys to volunteer for the family law clinic that they do, a pro bono family law clinic, which was a brilliant idea. And she succeeded. She met that goal when she was head of Access to Justice. So it's starting small, right? Getting people to do the small things first, you know, an event like the family law clinic or law days at the library or the Newtown Wills Project. And then you get kind of hooked. You get them hooked on the feeling of helping others. And that's kind of the way that you got to start. And then you go in. Once they're hooked, you got them. It's hard to it's hard to put down the work if you have the availability when there's a need.
Well, and I agree with you. I would almost venture to say part of your DNA, in so much as it, how you were raised and what you were exposed to, and exposure being a key element to that. And so, and you were referring to the internship that you had. And I know that Linda offers a number of interns, and anybody from high school through college through law school, if they want to participate in this office, and they're willing to work for free, I want them to be exposed to it because, as I'm fond of referring to Brian Stevenson, proximity gives relevance and meaning to things. And when you experience and you see for yourself the limitations that people are exposed to, there's a natural inclination to want to help, or at least I like to think there is. And so it does inspire a lot of people to participate. I know that you're not in your swan song and you're not just starting. So I commend you for your participation, because oftentimes for young attorneys, it's very difficult. They're struggling just to survive, so they can't seem to find the time. And so we get a lot of older near retirement attorneys who feel that they've done well and now it's time to give back to the community. But you're doing it in the middle of your career. So I want you to be the shining example for all other lawyers in this town to pick up the mantle and participate, considering how many people go unrepresented.
Well, you know, it is a lot of it too is a culture. Right. It's a culture at a firm. Like I mentioned, you know, two big firms that really don't have a presence here. But I mentioned Icard Barrel, which has a presence here. You know, Judge Bruning, when he was over, you know, with Morgan Bentley, he was building a culture over at that firm where he, you know, encouraged pro bono work in you know, over at Bentley. It's now Bentley Goodrich Keeson. They try to build that culture over there. They do a good job of when they have new associates, you know, those associates can see that their managing partners are encouraging and you know, it sort of gives them authorization to do it. It's basically what happened to me when I was with Andrew and Ed Boyer, you know, that seeing that encouragement, knowing that it was okay to do. Now, granted, you still have your, you know, I still make my goal, you know, I still have my monetary goals that I have to make for the firm, and, you know, but with what I do with guardianship and probate, it's easier to do it in chunks. So it doesn't take up as much time as, say, a full-blown civil case where you're doing discovery and deposition, and which that can just take a ton of time, even in a pro bono case, which wouldn't seem that complicated. But that the hard part is that civil litigation side. If you're gonna get yourself involved in a case like that, so it's basically the culture of where you are, your ability to do it, the culture and encouragement, and also being comfortable. Being comfortable in the area that you want to practice when it comes to doing a pro bono case.
And I think what you said is really key, and we hear that a lot, is that it really, the culture of the firm that someone works at. We have a lot of people who may come right out of law school and come talk to legal aid, hey, I want to get some experience, I want to volunteer. Then they may get hired at a firm that doesn't necessarily encourage, hopefully they don't actively discourage, pro bono work. And that makes it really difficult, as you said, when you're starting out and you have billable hours you have to meet, you have other networking and other professional responsibilities you have to meet. So having that firm culture is really, really important. And one of the things I try to explain to attorneys when I have one-on-one conversations or I have the opportunity to speak to groups of attorneys is I understand that attorneys are pulled in so many directions. They are really, they provide a lot to the community, not just in the legal sense, but community service. They have families, they're on, they sit on boards, etc. The problem we run into at Legal Aid is I can't ask anyone else to volunteer for me. Because we have a professional responsibility, only lawyers can go into court. And so I understand all the pulls on their time and things that they're already giving back to the community. But that's really our biggest challenge, is saying, yeah, we get it. You are doing a lot of good stuff. I can't ask the most well-meaning other community members to help. They're not allowed to go into court. They can't give legal advice. And so I think, I don't know how we get that message across to more attorneys and to the bar.
I mean, you can always just ask pretty please, but that doesn't always work.
It doesn't always.
I think the more people know that it's not, you're not going to get bogged down into some big 50-hour case, although I have before. My first big pro bono case was a double injunction for protection, and which was one heck of an experience, plus a custody. I think that took about 75 to 80 hours, but that was over a 6-month period of time. But once they realize it's just like a small.
Neil.
Yes, sir.
No, I didn't mean to interrupt, but you've given a good example. Tell me a little bit about that case that was and the service that is necessary, that is so oftentimes not provided, and people walk into court without representation. So you were saying it was a double injunction, but for the yes. Layperson, can you kind of lay out the experience?
Sure. It was essentially an adult woman with grandchildren. So the double was essentially her protection for her, and then protection for the four grandkids against some people that were threatening to do harm to them. Essentially, and without those injunctions, at least the individuals that were threatening to do harm to them, that they, you know, who knows what would have happened. I'm not saying that stopped them from doing harm, because an injunction is just a piece of paper without enforcement by law enforcement. But you know, the individuals that were threatening them got the message, and they backed off, and they hadn't had a problem since. But they were being threatened with harm, and they're also cyber stalking, which gets into its whole new discussion about what that actually is and what that actually means. But yeah, it was a double because it was an adult, and then minor children was the other one. And yeah, they were being threatened by nefarious individuals with plenty of evidence and whatnot, and that was a. Yeah. That was an interesting case, because I had to go in front of Judge Mercurio. I had never been in front of Judge Mercurio before, and I got a little taste of what it was like to be in front of Judge Mercurio, and it was a good experience. It was a very good experience. It was a terrible situation, but the experience was valuable.
Can you tell us?
Again,
go ahead, Larry.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I know that you've done. There's a delay. I think we lost Larry. Sorry. So I think it's really interesting that you brought up two points. One is that you're primarily an elder law attorney, and that's your area of specialty. And yet you delved outside of your area of comfort. You learned a new area of law, which is one of the things that we also try to encourage people that, hey, listen, this might be your practice area. We can provide some training, and you can help someone in the community if you want to learn a new area of law. But the other thing,
Linda, with that particular case, I would be remiss if I didn't mention like all the help I got on that one with, by like attorneys like Janella Leibowitz, Ryan Chapman, Jaime Del Castillo, Pam Fields, they all kind of teamed up to help me, do my case research and whatnot and show me where to look. My boss, Andrew, and I, we actually had kind of, he was sort of helping me look for some cases as well. And at the time, Andrew Boyer is what I'm talking about. So it was actually, again, the situation was terrible, but the actual service was enjoyable, just because it gets you out of your comfort zone. And I had people to help me. It wasn't like I was out there. I had mentors, like I said, Janella Leibowitz, Ryan Chapman, Jaime Del Castillo, Pam Fields, my boss, Andrew. I had mentors to help me through it.
which again is that's our role at Legal Aid. We need to provide the training, we need to provide the mentors, and that's what we're committed to do to make that possible. Because I think, and I don't know all the details of this case, but clearly it was pretty egregious for you to get involved and spend that time. And you imagine what would the outcome have been had you not stepped in to do that, and they had to go into court on their own. And I think that's what people really need to process is how scary that is. How many people just throw in the towel and say, I don't even know where the courthouse is. I don't know where to park, let alone getting in front of the judge and understanding the rules of evidence and what you need to do to present your case. So I think that's, again, just another important point that you make. Do you want to tell us a little bit? I know you've done some really incredible work. You talked about your guardian advocate work, kind of what that is, or maybe some of your other cases that you've handled on a pro bono basis.
Yeah, there's one that I did was a woman who was living in her mother's house, and she had never done a probate to get the title passed to her. And she was running into issues with the mortgage company, and she needed to refinance. But because the house wasn't in her name, she couldn't refinance the house. They wouldn't talk to her. So we had to get that house into her name. And she was indigent. You know, she was living on Social Security, I think, if that. And she had just enough to get a refi squared away. But that was it. And it wasn't much. And we were able to get a quick summary administration for her, thanks to, you know, Judge Moreland and Judge Williams has seen me do these a lot too in the probate courts. We were able to get that house into her name because it was hers based off of the intestate laws. Her mother didn't have a will, but she was her heir, and we were able to get it to her, and she was able to refinance the place and stay in it. Another one was a mother of a young girl who was hit by a car, hit and run, and suffered serious TBI when she was 16. Well, you know, when she turned 18, even though she had a TBI and she essentially wasn't able to do anything herself, the whole world considers her to be an adult. So, you know, her mother could no longer take her to the doctor. They couldn't share information with her without obtaining guardianship. And because the young lady she didn't have a developmental disability, her incapacity, as they say, wasn't from a developmental disability, it was from this TBI. Her mom wasn't eligible to do the guardian advocacy, so we had to go through full-blown plenary guardianship. And I think I remember correctly, I think it was Ted Gulnick who was the court-appointed attorney on that case as well. And that's the interesting part about guardianship, what people don't realize. There's two attorneys. There's the person who's helping the petitioner, and then there's the court-appointed attorney for the, as they say, the ward, the person who is alleged to be incapacitated. Neither of them both of them are serving pro bono for the, you know, for the most part. So on that one, that was Ted Gulnick who served. And I mean, I can't give a big enough shout out to the elder law community for doing as much work as they do on a lot of these cases. I mean, without them, they're just, we wouldn't be able to do this. You know, they're very, very generous with their time. And that's a community that I'm proud to be a member of too. So that one, the one for the mother with the young lady with the TBI, traumatic brain injury, That was a really, really emotional case. The mom sees me out in public and sometimes, and she tells my wife, oh, he's a hero. And my wife will just be like, yeah, well, he's still got to take out the trash. So, you know, it's one of those things.
Yes. Well, I have to say, go ahead.
Neil, what, based upon a non-scientific but empirical evaluation, how many cases go unrepresented?
Oh, I think 90.
I mean, how does a case like
it? By happen chance. That case came across my desk by happen chance. Ed walked into my office. I think somebody called Ed Boyer and said, hey, can you help us with something? And Ed came into my office and said, can you take a pro bono case? And it wasn't really Ed asking me if I could take a pro bono case. He says, I need you to do something. It's basically, I need you to do this for me. And I never, and if you know Ed, he's got a massive dedication to serving in this community and to giving back to the community. So I said, of course, yeah, of course I can. He wasn't really asking, but he knew I would do it. I didn't mind doing it. So it came across his desk, actually.
What would this person without representation?
I think if I got that correctly, Linda, do you think he was asking what would this person have done without representation?
I believe that's the case, yes.
Yeah, I have no idea.
Yes.
I have no clue.
Right.
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, hopefully in that situation, with as much as she needed, as much care as her daughter needed, I think eventually somebody would have pointed her in that direction, just because that's a very particular circumstance where the daughter's medical needs were very, very heavy. There are parents of children who have developmental disabilities who, you know, they take them to the doctor maybe once, twice a year, and the doctor's seen them. It's a family doctor. The doctor says, well, I've been giving you this information for years. All of a sudden, they have to get a new doctor. That new doctor's office says HIPAA. Now there's a HIPAA issue. So, you know, we may get a individual who is 30 years old with a developmental disability, and the parents finally find out they need to get a guardian advocacy for them.
Right. And I think the important thing that you and Larry just brought up is that's why legal aid people need to know legal aid exists, because people don't, mm-hmm. They may not recognize a legal issue. Second, if they do, they need to know where they can go to access that help. And that's why it's so important for us to build up our resources, because we don't want to be turning people away. Imagine that woman if she didn't have your help. So you just wonder where she would be. Again, it might have just taken her longer and just caused more aggravation and stress in an already very difficult situation. So, I think we're just about ready to wrap up. I want to thank you so much for being here. I want to congratulate you again. I will see you at Supreme Court tomorrow in Tallahassee as you accept your second pro bono award on behalf of the 12th Judicial Circuit. So congratulations. Thank you for, as your client said, a hero to many of us in the legal aid community. We really appreciate it.